happens. You know, the most obvious is using anonymous accounts, burner accounts, the same person operating multiple accounts to disseminate a particular narrative or version of me. What it comes down to and why I find this work is important is because beneath it all is an increasingly polarized society and one where people will justify hunting their neighbors because their neighbors say the wrong thing, were photographed with the wrong person, you know, don't believe this, they whatever they might feel is a righteous reason to target someone to try and have them canceled and lose their livelihood and be shunned from their families and shunned from other people is extremely toxic. And, you know, it there's no due process associated with it. It connects to what's happening on the streets with protests. And so, you know, there is this industrial complex around hate in Canada. There are people who benefit on either side of the spectrum from having enraged followers.
You're talking about like online media monetization? That's the industrialized hate?
Yeah, that's a component of it. And again, like it is not isolated to one end of the spectrum, although the most targeting that I have received happens to come from people who would call themselves progressive.
At one point, you would run afoul of the people, I guess, more on the kind of libertarian right and the anti-vax part of that. But more vociferously and more recently, it's been people who would identify as being on the progressive left.
Yeah, and I set out thinking that, you know, the libertarians were the ones we needed to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm.
In actual fact, we need a more even-handed enforcement and political systems and processes that actually are impartial and fair and not going to treat someone differently because of their ideology.
I would say that you are correct that people are behaving to their neighbors in ways that would previously be unthinkable in the things that people are willing to say and do. And I think that the prerequisite is that righteousness that you referred to. If you can effectively convince yourself or others, or you are convinced that somebody is on the side of terrible things, well, then what does their reputation matter? I describe this not oblivious to the fact that there's aspects of just doing journalism in which I could be accused of doing the same thing. And I think that what we're seeing is wide distribution of a lot of the dynamics of journalism without any of the rigors or the checks and balances of journalism. When you report that somebody has done something terrible, you very well may be affecting their life in a terrible way, and which is why we have things like getting their side of the story as a part of it. All of which is to say that in people's attempts to figure out, are you fish or fowl, who are you and what do you support and what do you believe and what is your place in this, because you're not identifiable, you're not on one side of the protest or the other, and you're not there under a media company's banner, and you're not there making money, so it's hard to figure you out. When people learn that you defend somebody like Jeremy McKenzie, who is part of Diagolon, which is widely felt to be some sort of a violent right-wing racist threat, and I think has been described even by Pierre Poilievre as losers and dirtbags or something like that for the comments they made about his wife, that's like case closed to a lot of people who are wondering if you are a part of the racist right. What do you say to that conclusion?
I don't need to get into, I think, the cliche conversation of a lawyer doesn't equal their clients and doesn't have to endorse or agree with or support.
Everybody deserves a defense.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that I think has been completely lost.
Mm-hmm.
I had the pleasure of interviewing Alan Borovoy, who was the founder of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, and a Jewish man who defended Nazis. He defended child pornographers. Because if you care about civil liberties, they are defended at the extreme fringe. He defended people who had views that he felt were abhorrent because he believed in their right to say these things, even if he disagreed with the content, which is like a very simple, classic
principle. And I think objectively correct.
if you believe in, I don't know, our civilization and the way that we do things and the idea of civil liberties.
Right.
Like if you believe in human rights, I guess.
Yeah.
Which not everybody has to or does, but that is the idea, is that we all have them. It doesn't matter what you do with those rights, you have them regardless. But we are in an age of guilt by association where people can be, okay, we've got, she's associated with Chris Skye and she's associated with Jeremy McKenzie. And if I can find a couple of other things, and who are her enemies? That's a big one. Are her enemies my friends?
Mm-hmm.
That can kind of add up to like, okay, she's fair game.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's, I mean, there's something tribal about that, which I don't think is conducive to nuance or critical thinking.
Here is something that is also very confusing to the people who are trying to block your camera, or I saw somebody saying, this is a Zionist videographer referring to your videographer. Here's a complicating factor. You're Palestinian.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that your father dying from COVID has to have a relationship to your journalism about the anti-vax movement, I have to imagine that the fact that you're Palestinian is related or connected or relevant in talking about the copious amount of documentation that you've been doing of the pro-Palestine movement. But I don't know what that connection is.
My videographer happens to be Jewish. I happen to be Palestinian. And I think that, you know, that of course it shapes our perspective on the global events. We really honed in on, you know, what is the issue we're tackling is the Canadian response to global events.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. That's who I am, right?
And do you have a public position on the conflict in the Middle East?
I mean, my position is that, like, let's enforce the Geneva Convention, right? Let's actually have a functioning regime of international law. So, you know, that's my... my position is, let's enforce international law.
Let me close by asking you this. Where do you think all of this is heading? I think that people have been hopeful that it's gotten as bad as it's going to get, and cooler heads are prevailing, and it's going to die down. It's going to calm down.
I don't know why anyone thinks that. That's nice to be optimistic, but I'm not sure what evidence supports that belief. I don't think that we're running out of steam or fuel anytime soon. And even if the polarization is not temporary or superficial, I think it runs very deep. And I think that it's hard work to actually try and mend or repair or create those bridges. But if we are to have a shot in the future, I think that that's an essential bit of what we're required to do. Be neighborly to the people who you don't actually maybe want as neighbors, but we're all in this together, right? No one is going to be exiled, or, you know, you can't just toss people in jail for no reason because we don't like what they think. And I'm not saying that we're on that road, but there is a viciousness in the way that people are interacting with one another. And I don't think that that evaporates on its own. I think that we have to consciously decide not to indulge. And it can feel good, I think, to indulge in that, to be part of a mob canceling someone, right? To be part of a,
mm-hmm.
There's that righteousness, you know, we're on the good path, on the moral path, and it's addictive. And there's a bit of self-preservation, because if it's not him, it could be you. And so
yeah.
I'll be extra loud about it. But that's not sustainable. That was bleak. I'm sorry. But I just don't see the...
It wasn't. It was much more optimistic than I am, because it sounds like you're suggesting that we can somehow resolve or talk our way through this or sit down together. And I'm not sure I believe that. I feel like this thing has to somehow... I feel like it's going to play itself out. And all I can see is... Well, I'd like to think that journalism can play a role in giving people the information they need to not go down the worst path possible. I don't always believe that that's true, at which point I sort of default to just a belief that, well, if this is going to happen, we have to keep good records.
There you have it.
Karima, thank you.
Thank you.
That is your Canada Land episode. You can email me about it at jesse@canadaland.com. You can also find me on Blue Sky. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Production assistance from Max Collins. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the news. Mostly we'll talk about ChatGPT versus Canada's legacy news media, which might go down a lot like Jake Paul versus Mike Tyson. Welcome back to the show, Harrison Lohman.
How's it going, Jesse?
It's going good. Glad to have you here. Harrison, last week the news broke that the Globe and Mail, the Canadian Press, the CBC, the Toronto Star, Metroland Media, and Post Media are collectively suing OpenAI, and they are alleging that OpenAI is strip mining journalism and unjustly enriching itself by using our precious news articles, well, their precious news articles, to train ChatGPT software.
Can you tell me about the lawsuit?
ChatGPT can give you a tailored headline about the lawsuit against it.
Canadian media companies have filed a lawsuit against OpenAI.
Some of Canada's largest media companies allege it can only do that because its parent company, OpenAI, scrapes stories from the web, including Canadian ones, to train it.
Some of Canada's largest publishers are suing OpenAI for allegedly scraping information from its articles and repurposing them in ChatGPT without permission.
The Canadian news brands want up to $20,000 for each article. For each article! Every article that's been used to train artificial intelligence by OpenAI, they want up to $20,000 for. So if they win in court, it could potentially be worth billions. What do you think?
You're talking to the right guy, Jesse, because my dad is an intellectual property lawyer. So last night I was asking about this. He says they have a case, literally the word copyright. You can't be copying it or using it to sort of train the AI, especially if it's being used for commercial purposes. The ChatGPT, they're making money off this. There's exceptions around, you know, we both know fair dealing, personal use, educational purposes, etc. But to your point, you know, the money for each article, you need direct evidence of the scraping. And that wasn't mentioned in the initial statement of claim. You need proof of that occurring in each instance. And the trial, he says, could take like almost 4 years. So I look at that, but I also look at something I know you often talk about, which is like, is this where us as an industry should be putting our attention? Sometimes it feels like we're looking for money to offset like a revenue problem that we can't get to the bottom of and wrap our heads around. Maybe this culminates in some sort of partnership between these companies and ChatGPT, and they get some money out of this, some sort of alliance.
Ding, ding, ding.
Ding, ding,
yeah,
ding.
Let's take this in two parts, because first there's the actual, does the Canadian media have a case? Is this legitimate? And then there's like, well, why are they doing this? And I have been pretty vocal in the past, because this is very familiar. This sounds a lot like when the Canadian newspaper lobby group and a bunch of others went after Facebook and Google for stealing news. Now there's like, you know, you could easily say that's the same thing. You know, they went and they said that Facebook and Google were stealing news. Now they're saying that OpenAI stealing news. And in both cases, like, it's a pretty thinly veiled cash grab. I think there's a difference here. I did not ever buy the argument that Facebook and Google were stealing news. We wanted our news.
Yes. Yes.
We wanted
the views.
I still want. I miss the traffic from Facebook and Instagram and now Threads. So we wanted to be stolen. If we were being stolen from, we wanted that. I don't think we want OpenAI to train on our articles, especially now that they're developing products that do replace the news. I know people who've stopped reading the news. They just go to ChatGPT and they ask for news updates. You've hit on an interesting snag in the case. Can they prove, because like, do we have access, maybe discovery, they could get access to OpenAI's files to find out if they've been training OpenAI on Canadian news articles, or maybe there's a way to reverse engineer that and prove it. I agree with your dad, who obviously has more expertise than I do, but I do feel like this is stealing. Here's what the companies are saying. Here's a quote. The companies collectively said, journalism is in the public interest. OpenAI using other companies' journalism for their own commercial gain is not. That's not true. Like, ChatGPT giving people free summaries of the news is in the public interest. It's not in the news company's interest. It's not in our interest as news publishers. So I actually think that there is a case here. But to the second part of your point, Harrison, why are they doing this? Like, are we actually going to see a 4-year trial? Are we going to see that, like, punitive damages of $20,000 an article? No, they are trying to incentivize a licensing deal. I think the only Canadian media that picked up on this was The Conversation. There was a piece by Robert Diab, professor at Thompson Rivers University. And in that piece, he asked the real question, is the Canadian lawsuit just a ploy to land a big licensing deal? After all, OpenAI has struck licensing deals with a number of news organizations and publishers, including News Corp, the Financial Times, and the Associated Press. So I think the Canadian publishers are saying, hey, how about us? It's funny that it's a copyright issue because New York Times did it first. New York Times is suing OpenAI for training OpenAI on the Times content. So that we don't want to be left out. Like, if the New York Times...
It's so Canadian.
It's so Canadian. Let somebody else take the risk. Let somebody else with deeper pockets absorb a lot of the legal fees and build the case precedent and the argument and the strategy precedent for this. And not just the New York Times, like Sarah Silverman is suing OpenAI. George R.R. Martin and a dozen other authors are suing OpenAI.
A Game of Thrones erupting over the rights to some of the most popular works in the world.
Winter is coming.
George R.R. Martin and more than a dozen other authors now suing OpenAI, creator of ChatGPT.
We have some news just coming in this morning. The New York Times suing OpenAI, the creator of ChatGPT, and Microsoft for copyright infringement.
Comedian Sarah Silverman has joined forces with two authors to sue Bay Area-based companies, Meta and OpenAI.
I think you're right. It's not necessarily like stop doing this artificial intelligence. It's you have money and we don't. The payday for all of this content has shifted out of our pockets. And that gets back to the original Canadian thing, which is like, who cares who's wrong or who's right? We used to get paid and now you're getting paid and that's not fair. So it's a shakedown.
I see it this way, Jesse. Like, I often find, you know, our industry, you've said this before, like, we seem to be the only industry that blames our customer, and we're always outward looking instead of inward looking. And in this case, we're looking for another life raft instead of fixing the damn boat that's sinking. Like, guys, let's look inwardly and figure out, I don't know, at least try to fix this as opposed to looking for more life rafts that can provide some sort of steady stream of revenue so that we continue to do the same thing we're doing for the last few years.
I have more faith in the whole thing collapsing entirely and something completely new. I don't think that Post Media or I know what's going on in those companies. Like, and you don't have to be an insider. Like, what product release or service development from like Torstar gives you any faith that they're still legitimately trying to build a news business? Like, there's nothing they're doing that supports that point of view. Or Post Media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've known the story that they're just wringing the last bits of value out of their assets and their advertising revenue streams and then torch the place like that restaurant in Goodfellas. You know, like that's what's happening. You know, I can't act surprised about it anymore.
Not to mention the subsidies. When a new government comes in, the hub does not take the media subsidies from the federal government. A new government will come in and those life rafts will be popped suddenly. And we will be counting down the days in terms of them turning off the lights off in these places. And it'll be tragic in some ways.
That's a great point. And I'll remind people as often as I can that we need people's support because we don't take government media subsidies. We want our support. It's a principle thing that I want our support to be based on people actually wanting Canada Land and valuing it and not this forced payment from government. But it's also a survival thing, because when you become dependent on those things, this is really bad. When Polyev comes in, not only is he going to defund the CBC, but he will kill the QCJO salary subsidy, which is like a major, it didn't succeed in actually saving news jobs or news organizations, but it sustained a bunch.
It kept them afloat. Let's keep the ocean metaphors going. It kept them afloat. There you go.
It's going to get deflated like very suddenly. Yes. So as a matter of survival, I'm glad that we never took that money. This Canadian thing, war on big tech, but war once the big guys have rushed in first. It's not just going after OpenAI. The other thing that we've talked about for years is, why are we shaking down Google for these licensing payments when really the regulatory response to Google is antitrust? And I think listeners have heard me talk about that with a lot of people over the years, and Canada has not had any interest in that. We haven't seen any real push towards breaking up Google or the Competition Bureau going after Google until the Americans did it first. We'll be back to talk about that after this break. We just saw news that Canada's Competition Bureau is suing Google over its online advertising model.
The Bureau accuses the tech giant of anti-competitive practices in the online advertising sector. It seeks an order to force Google to sell two of its ad tech tools and impose penalties to ensure compliance with competition laws. Google, however, denies the accusations and claims the ad market remains competitive with plenty of options for buyers and sellers. This lawsuit mirrors ongoing antitrust efforts in the United States and the European Union, where Google faces scrutiny over similar concerns.
Harrison, you're an editor. I'm an editor and a publisher. And so I do have a conflict of interest to disclose here. These things affect Canada Land very much. I definitely looked at this news as a publisher, the first bit about OpenAI, when I saw all the big publishers in Canada suing OpenAI. And I thought, I hope I don't get left out of this if they win. Because, this isn't like the stuff that's being done through these collectives or these consortiums. This is just the big companies got together and sued. Not that I can afford legal fees to take part in this lawsuit. So I definitely am wondering, if they actually can get OpenAI to, pay licenses, which I'd be very happy to take. If they're going to build this multi-billion-dollar product based on our content, and as I understand AI, they build it on all content. I'm not really sure how this Google antitrust thing affects the lot of Canadian media. I know that the Competition Bureau in Canada does not have teeth. The person running it is apparently serious, but I think that we just don't have the legislation that allows us to break up companies. I think this might just be a question of positioning. If larger jurisdictions are effectively strong-arming Google to sell off, to actually break it up and sell off some of its products, I wonder if this isn't just Canada trying to get in a position where we can demand the same things once the precedent is set.
I would just tell viewers who aren't in media, your listeners who aren't in media, that we live and die by this algorithm, and it's often staring into a black hole. We're often doing things and we're trying to figure out, we did the same thing a few weeks ago. Why is this doing worse? And it's all based on whatever the folks at Google are deciding should get top spot, should get bottom spot, should be in the middle. Yeah, they're an overlord in a way.
My smugness has taken a couple of hits because I felt for many years that being kind of like a old school internet guy who mostly by accident built this company on an open standard, RSS, podcasts are not platformed and subject to algorithms, or at least they're not supposed to be. Anybody can publish a podcast. And I thought that made us, kind of algorithm proof. But there's no escaping these companies. As the companies get bigger and bigger, consumption of podcasts goes through Apple and Spotify. Apple has been pretty good about come one, come all, and their business model isn't really intertwined with podcasting, so it's really just a service they provide. There's a little bit of curatorial stuff with who they feature, which they've been cool about. Spotify's definitely like a black box. As more and more of listenership creeps up on Spotify, you do have to start wondering, what kind of podcasts does Spotify like this week? What kind of titles does Spotify, And you start playing that game, and before you know it, you kind of don't want to succeed, because then when you succeed, then you're beholden to it, and they can change that. Those algorithms change themselves by machine learning.
And they're different often. I don't think it's beneficial for you to constantly view them as just an enemy, right? you should try to, you know, figure out the secret sauce and use them to the best of your advantage. This is the situation we're in. We need to propel ourselves through them.
Yeah, look, there's the soft diplomacy of, like, just doing business and trying to be, like, if they're going to favor some content and some publishers and not others, then let's line up and kiss their butts. But regulation, I think, has a role to play in this. I feel like we do have to figure out the rules for these players, right?
And what we've been finding, Jesse, with a lot of this stuff is it ends up in front of a court this many years later, in front of judges who have no clue what the hell any of this has to mean. You think they're going to know what ChatGPT is? There's an 80-year-old guy who's like, how do you post the video? You can't get ahead of it. A lot of this stuff is inevitable, and it's moving at a million miles an hour. But hopefully we can wrap our arms around it to a certain extent and at least have the rules of play out there.
I think we got to move past that, because I think there was an early stage of attempted regulation of big tech where, you know, we saw Zuckerberg before those American legislators, and they looked like dinosaurs.
How many data categories do you store? Does Facebook store on the categories that you collect?
Senator, can you clarify what you mean by data category?
Could somebody call you up and say, I want to see John Kennedy's file?
Absolutely not.
Quite a story, right? Dorm room to the global behemoth that you guys are. Only in America, would you agree with that?
Senator, mostly in America.
You couldn't do this in China, right?
I think the takeaway from that was Zuckerberg is smarter than these guys. They're the past. He's the future. Leave him alone and let him build these amazing, you know, this amazing company. And that was a horrible conclusion to draw from that. Like, the conclusion to draw from that is that our legislators need to be younger, and they need to know what the f*** they're doing, and they need to understand this technology that is increasingly important in our lives so that they can actually write effective legislation, not just get out of the way and let the free market do its thing. Because, dear God, that was a big mistake. Harrison, that is our show for today. I want to thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Where can people find you?
Sure. I'm at www.thehub.ca, or you can catch me on Twitter. I'm at HARRISONLOWMAN.
This episode is produced by Sam Connert, mixing and mastering by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins. Lucy Lomonier did the fact-checking. I'm Jesse Brown, the editor and publisher of Canada Land. You can email me about anything you heard today at jesse@canadaland.com. I'm on Blue Sky as well. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Les voix locales comptent. Les vôtres, la mienne, les autres de cette station. La radio communautaire est importante. Vous le savez, je le sais. Et il est maintenant temps pour le gouvernement de reconnaître l'importance de la radio communautaire. Parce qu'avec du soutien, des stations comme celle-ci continueront à faire des choses incroyables. Le plan s'appelle l'initiative de la radio communautaire. Et nous avons besoin de vous pour visiter monirc.ca. Ensemble, nous pouvons faire une différence pour nos communautés. monirc.ca.